inside the feral zone.
Greetings, listeners. Welcome back inside the feral zone. I'm Renee Komen, operating under cover of darkness from Snake and Jake's Christmas Club Lounge here in the heart of the Klempire. The Feral Zone is a sister podcast to the Troubled Men podcast. It appears in this space from time to time. Tonight is one of those times. Not sure what's going on with Manny, but time will tell. Tonight we have a terrific guest with us here. He's a world-famous, multi-Grammy-winning violinist, accordion player, singer, songwriter, founder and band leader of Cajun superstar group Beausoleil. He's released dozens of records over the last 50 years. He's an international ambassador of Cajun and Creole music since the 1970s. He's been at the forefront of spreading this music from South Louisiana around the world. He's appeared on such shows as Austin City Limits, Late Night with Conan O'Brien, Prairie Home Companion. We're going to get into all that and much more. But without further ado, the great Mr. Michael Doucet. Welcome, Michael.
Hey, bonjour, René. Comment ça va?
All right. I like it. Well, so Michael, you know, here we are in Snake and Jake's Christmas Club Lounge. You said you might have been here during the daytime one time. I said, that's not a good sign. Usually that means you've been here all night.
But I think so. I think it's the kind of place that you wake up your eyes, oh, this is where I am.
Right.
You
know? Sure.
Somebody else takes you here, you have no idea where you are. It's like
right?
A different planet. I love it.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Well, and it's interesting. So you look from the outside, and it looks like the size of a tool shed. And then you come through the front door, and it's much bigger. It's like Narnia or something, like walking through the closet. You know?
Narnia. That's at the other side of the secret garden here. It yeah. Kind of looks like a tool shed, but I don't know what I mean. I guess with red lights, so.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Maybe a little bit more on the satanic tip, but just playing. It's all roses in here. So you're in New Orleans. You live in Lafayette currently, right?
Correct. Yes.
But you used to have a place here in town.
Yes,
huh?
I really loved it. It was like for a year I lived in the Quarter on Charter Street. I actually never slept the whole night since the whole time I was here, but I had a great time because I'm kind of a student of history, and so I used to get all these books about New Orleans, which I love, and you know, go back in the history, and you can walk to every street, and it was just a pleasant time. But as far as the Cajun music bringing here, I guess you could say it was at Jed's that first got Cajun music here. That's across from the Maple Leaf.
Oh yeah, yeah, I played Jed's many times as a kid.
You know, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, that's how we kind of got to New Orleans. Before that, we were just the heathens from the bayous.
Huh.
You know?
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, before we get into all that, let's you're here in town playing a date tomorrow, and first of all, how was your weekend? Were you in Lafayette?
No, I was here. We had a great time. No, we played last Thursday night at the Manship Theater in Baton Rouge.
Oh, okay.
And we do it's kind of a seasonal show. I did this album, solo album, back in 1986 called Christmas Bayou.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's just I Cajunized some Christmas songs and plays French songs. So we did that last week. That's what we're going to be doing at the cathedral. But it was just nice being here. I mean, my son Ezra lives here.
Oh, okay.
And his wife. And so it's nice visiting. We stay with an old friend, Glenn Pete and Michelle Benoit. And it was just that, you know, I saw Rob Savoy this morning.
Sure.
I mean, you know,
okay.
So we're taking that time and just visiting people. I have a friend who just has built a second house, small little house in Waveland, Mississippi. And that was nice just getting out there. It's just an hour away.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
We've been having pretty much fun, you know, eating our way through New Orleans, as they say.
Right.
But it's nice to be here. There's not jazz festival.
Yes.
And it's all crazy. And so, of course, we're going to go to the Roosevelt tomorrow. You know, we have to do something.
Yeah, yeah. It's all decorated with Christmas lights and all kind of stuff. Yeah, it's impressive there at the Fairmont Roosevelt. Well, so I had a good weekend here. I was went down to some galleries on Julia Street on Saturday night, and then I went to a restaurant I'd never been to before. It's called the Franklin. It's kind of down in the Bywater area, And I got to say, the food was delicious. I got to say, my faith in young people and their sense of play has been renewed.
Because, wow, you know, they seem
so serious sometimes. But
they're on a mission.
Yeah. Suicide mission.
Suicide mission. Exactly. We will fail.
but this waitress we had, it was just my wife and I. And at some point during the meal, my wife says, "What is that on the waitress's ear?" I said, "I can't see." I said, "Which ear?" She said, "You know, I guess it was her left ear." And I said, "Well, that's always facing you. I'm not seeing it." So she goes, "Well, try to see when she comes back." So I never could. But then as we're paid up, we're leaving the restaurant, and the girl's facing me face on, and I can see the thing. It's like a big white thing hanging off of her ear. And I turned back, I turned on my heels, and I go, "Excuse me, what is that on your ear?" She goes, "Man, oh man." She pulls it off. She goes, "Look, this is like a giant, like a clip that would come on a bag of bread, you know, except way big. It's like a real, like one of these just single pieces of plastic that has kind of two pincers on one end, you know, but it's like 2 inches by 3 inches. It's huge." And she said, "This came off of some package of food back in the kitchen, and just for laughs, I said, let me put this on my ear and see if anybody mentions it." And she said, "All night long, nobody would ask." And finally you asked, and I was like, "Wow." She goes, I said, "It's a bit." She goes, "It's just a bit, man." I was like, "All right, I love that."
It was as good as the food.
Well, you know, it was icing on the cake, I would say. You know, yeah, the food was outstanding. Then, so that was Saturday night. Then Sunday, the Iguanas played a gig at the Broadside. Now, I don't know if Beausoleil has played that venue yet.
We did when it first started, like before COVID. We did that when he was outside.
Well, that's why they started, because of COVID. They started the outside thing. The outside space is great if you have like 1,000 people coming to see you there. But now they've built an indoor room that holds a few hundred. And,
oh, really?
Yeah. Wow. It's air conditioned and heated. And
well, that's what they needed. Well, hope we played there. It sounds good, man.
And it's in to my mind, quickly becoming one of the go-to showcase venues in town, because the people that run it are super cool. And we had a show there, and it was so many people. It turned out it was like my children, my parents, high school friends, my sister, all kind of music friends.
God, a reunion.
All kind of. So I'm looking out there. At some point, I was thinking, did I die and this is my wake? You know, it's like, it kind of looked like, the crowd that would have been there.
Well,
anyway,
you should have a party, you know, before. Who wants it? Because you can't have that great party we're going to have when you do die. So it's good to be part of it now.
Well, yeah, that's
because we'll be there.
Yeah, if I play gigs, then I don't have to have a party. You know,
that's right. That's good. I'm glad that's there, man. Yeah, we played. Where was it? Chickiwawa's a couple times. You know.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Still miss Dale, but Patrick's doing a great job.
Yeah. It's still a great room. It's just can be a little bit of a steep climb with the nut they have over there.
It's always something.
Right. Well, so you were mentioning that you're in town playing St. Louis Cathedral tomorrow with Beausoleil, part of their Christmas program. Now, I did that a few years ago, a couple of times. I played it with the Iguanas. I also played it with Susan Cowsill. And you got to talk into the microphone.
Yes, Michael. I'm sorry. This is how good I am on stage. You know, talk into the mic. I need a lavalier.
But have you played there before? I assume you have, at St. Louis Cathedral.
Yeah, we played there about 5 years ago, or 6 years, something like that.
Okay. Now, I'm not Catholic now, but I was raised Catholic. And I got to say, being in that space was one of the most imposing venues to play in. It's just the gravity of the whole thing, the way it looks, you know, the height of it. It's like, wow. I mean, I was nervous not to play the music, just to be there.
That's exactly right. For some reason, it's intimidating. You feel like there's somebody else looking in front of your shoulder. Well, you know, I mean, there is somewhere.
Well, I think that architecture is intentional. Yeah, I think that's part of the Catholic Church's scheme.
Oh, they got it right. Isn't that amazing about the Notre Dame? Did you see some of those pictures? I mean, it looks so beautiful. But, I mean, it's really nice to play there. Yeah, I mean, once you get into it, I mean, all of these songs are not all secular that we do. Most of them are. But, I mean, there's no cussing. You know, we
sure,
got rid
sure.
of
that. Yeah. Well, you know, you got to have a sense of decorum, you know.
But it is Christmas.
Know the room, as they say.
Whoever doesn't cuss for Christmas, something's wrong. Somebody's never tried to put a tricycle together at 2 o'clock in the morning after drinking a couple of bottles of wine.
Sure.
Look up.
Oh, yeah. I can definitely see see the fur flying in that scenario. Well, so, Michael, let's go back a little bit. Tell us about where you were born, where you grew up, the Lafayette area?
No, my dad was a pilot in the Air Force, he wanted to make a career but my mother didn't see it exactly the same way. So before they had my older sister, I got out of the Air Force and he moved back home. He was actually an orphan at 12. His parents were born like in the 1870s, but he was raised by his eldest sister. He was 20 years older than him. So in those days, you had a big family because you had a lot of land to farm. And so there was this property along US 90. I mean, it must have been, I guess, a mile or something long. And we had all the relatives living right there on that side of the road.
Uh-huh.
And it went back, you know, everybody had, I guess, I don't know, about 50, 60 acres. So I had a horse. I grew up on a horse, and that's what we did. It was so freeing. Little did I know. I mean, I didn't go to, we were talking about, you know, somebody asked me, did you go to kindergarten? I said, kindergarten? You had to wear shoes for that. And it says, no way I went to kindergarten. But, I mean, I was more in tune to my uncle, T. Will, who was the person my mother asked me not to hang around with. Of course I did. He had a racetrack right in between our house and his in his field, but it was a quarter horse racetrack, a quarter mile long. Uh-huh. And so they had these, it's called a China Bowl racetrack because they had these old China Bowl trees and used to put me up in the tree to see who won, you know, because they didn't trust the guy at the end with the flag, uh-huh. You know, to see that. And so that's how I grew up. And he also played violin. So he showed me three songs pretty much when I was about 12, but I never had the violin for myself because we had so many kids, you know.
Right.
And so I grew up around music. Both sides of the family played. I mean, we'd get together and there'd be like a trombone, a piano, accordion, fiddle, who knows, you know. And singing, because my father had five sisters, two of them sang ballads and French ballads.
So I was going to say, so y'all spoke Creole French or Cajun French?
Well, we say Acadian right. French because Acadian it's French. A 17th century French, mm-hmm. and it's what, you know, they carried with them.
Right.
yeah, definitely I guess, you know, my parents and my grandmother, you know, my grandmother had been a nurse at a Touro from a small town. So, I mean, they knew the world. And I guess they just said, well, you should learn two languages anyway. So
Nice. Basically
that's how we grew up. But I remember people my age, I mean, you know, in those days, everybody spoke French. And it had nothing to do with color, you know, because, I mean, that was an area that was very agricultural. You know, everybody had farms in the old days, not then, but everybody had cow or cattle. I mean, we had chickens, sheep, and we had horses, of course, cattle. And so, and bees. And so it was just, you know, he wanted to come back and make it a working farm.
Right on.
Which, to my chagrin, I'm not a great milker at 4 o'clock in the morning. And so I was glad when we started eating the cows instead of milking them. But I know how to make butter.
Okay. Well, I know that for a certain period of time, I mean, maybe a long time, Acadian French was suppressed in certainly the schools and stuff.
Well,
were you of the age group where that was still being suppressed, or it didn't? It was too late. You already spoke from.
No. I wouldn't say suppressed, but it was different. It still was. I mean, we had that stigma that we were, you know, almost second class because we, you know, we weren't Americans. I mean, come on, we didn't have a television until the late 50s, and so everything was very much the way it had been for a long time. And the families are so big. The extended families are really big. I mean, I'm talking about a get together. You'd have 20-something people,
right.
And they're all close relations, you
right?
know? And so, my parents' generation had that particular thing. But funny, my grandfather could read and write French, beautiful handwriting. So it's terrible how he went back and forth. They know that problem, But it didn't stop anybody from doing anything. When my father became a pilot, and he was always interested in flying, he hung out at the airport. His nickname was Frenchie. Surprise, surprise. Okay. And he was, you know, I mean, he was like teased and everything till he got to France. Then he became everybody's good buddy.
Okay, right, right, right. Came in handy. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, but as kids, I mean, we knew, even went to a Catholic school in Lafayette, because we lived out, we didn't live in any city, it was out in the country, sort of. And, you know, there was a difference from, I'll just call them des Americains, you know, people who weren't born in Louisiana or something, and they would like teachers who weren't from here, they would mispronounce our names and make fun of that stuff, you know. And, I mean, that's kind of, you know, water rolling off our duck's back. It didn't bother me at all. We're used to that kind of stuff. But I didn't have the kind of severity that some people had being punished for speaking this and getting really a stigma. And, like, I mean, the joke is the two kids go up to school and, you know, they were taking a math class and they just speak French. So the teacher says, say one. And they say one. Then they say two. And they say, okay, bye. You know, that kind of thing.
Well, so this big extended family had a musical tradition, like you were saying, all these people. So is that kind of would you try to chime in on some instrument?
Of course, everybody would. I mean,
dances or house dances
we had. My father was really good at that. My father loved to dance, and he'd bring me to different places. I was just telling somebody yesterday that the earliest experience I have is he brought me to a place called Mardi Boulet, where they had a racetrack called T. Maurice, and they had a dance on the Sundays. And a great Cajun musician by the name of Lawrence Walker was playing there, who my dad knew. And so my job was, in those days, for a beer can, you didn't have a pull tab or anything. You had this machine, this kind of lever. You put it down, and it made two holes. One was a triangle, one was just so you could drink the beer.
All right.
That was my job at like 6 years old. And my job was to hand it to the musician. So
nice.
I said, I handed a beer to Lawrence Walker. I mean, not that I knew who Lawrence Walker was at that time.
Right.
But I knew, I mean, it was so cool. I said, this guy's playing music, you know. And then the other side of the family, my aunt, my second cousin, basically, played with a swing orchestra, a Harry Gregg swing orchestra. So the family played for that until I flatted too many sevenths and tried to do, I just discovered a flatted nine. And it was much to the chagrin. So I got kicked out of that.
The altered tensions are not going to be tolerated.
No. Oh, no. I just thought it was neat. Let's just try it.
Right.
I knew better than flatted five. But
right, well, it makes a nice resolution from the five to the minor one. You know, if you're playing in a minor key, it's
why did he understand that?
Just listen, Dad. Doesn't it sound cool?
But music was good. We had I had a cousin who lived, that same, you know, down the road. I mean, I guess I don't know how far, maybe half a mile. He played trumpet, and so we used to play trumpet together and answer each other. I mean, that's how quiet it was in those days.
Right.
Can you imagine doing that now?
So you played trumpet?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
In fact, that's where I met Sonny Landreth. We were both some, you know, state band, and, you know, said, oh, yeah, I heard of you. So you play trumpet. I play guitar. Well, you play guitar. Okay.
Oh, yeah. I knew Sonny was a trumpet player, but so you went through school band playing trumpet?
Well, not exactly the school thing, because where I went to school, music wasn't part of the curriculum.
Oh, all right.
So you had to get there. The school started at 8 o'clock in the morning. You had to be at the band at 6:30 or 7, and you didn't get credit for it. And we had terrible uniforms. We never could buy our own, you know, marching band uniforms. There was a school down the road.
Right.
It's called Paul Breaux Elementary, or Paul Breaux High. And they were the best bands in town. I mean, they were cool. They knew all the rhythms. So they get new uniforms. We had the same color, purple and gold. So we always had their cast off.
Okay.
So, no, I didn't do it in high school. But I still played music in high school.
Right, right. I was reading somewhere that your first instrument was really like banjo, huh?
It was a banjo. I wanted a guitar. I mean, it was like, I was like, you know, I was into the country people. I mean, real country. I mean, country, the Western people, not country, but Western people, like, you know, Roy Rogers and, there were so many people in those days. But I mean, I was...
Gene Autry. Kind of stuff,
Gene Autry,
right.
He was the one. I really liked Gene Autry. So I was a cowboy. But at the same time, I knew all the words to Elvis's songs, 1950s. So they used, I was like, here's my kid. He's dressed like a cowboy. He's singing Elvis, which must have been something. And here's a little tidbit. Mm-hmm. You love this. So there was this talent show in Scott. And of course, I had to be there. You had my boots on and everything. with a banjo, which I've come, I mean, I tore that instrument apart to became just the, how would you say, just the Joe. I mean, I turned the neck off.
Now, is that a five-string banjo, four-string banjo?
It was just a four-string banjo because my cousin, T. Will, that my uncle played banjo too. It wasn't a very good one. But anyway, so I had the banjo, learned how to play that. I mean, you know, two, three chords. And anyway, so we did this show, and I don't win, but, you know, my cousin Keith Thibodeau is on the same show. He has a drum set. I mean, you know what it was like to be, like, 6 years old and hear a drum set? I mean, everybody wanted to be Krupa.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so long story short, he won, and then he went up to Shreveport for the state finals. Well, it just so happens that a producer, Desi Lou, was passing through, heard him play, and he became Little Ricky on the I Love Lucy show.
Oh, really?
You believe it or not, yeah. So anyway, I didn't make it, but he did.
Okay. Well, I was also reading that you had a early sort of Cajun rock band with your cousin, Zachary Richard, which I didn't realize that was your cousin.
Third cousin.
Okay.
Related to the Boudreaux. It was basically, he was Mick Jagger and I was Keith Richards.
Nice. And, well, you picked the right one.
It was ironic because I got to play and record with the expensive winos with Keith Richards.
That's so cool, man.
I tell you what, Renee, was like, he was just like us.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a consummate musician. I mean, then he started drinking Rebel Yell and stuff like that. And he gave me a great compliment. He said, I asked him if I could use it. He said, Keith Richards says, if I'd played fiddle, I play like you.
Oh, man.
I said, well, Keith, if I could play guitar, I'd play like you too. But, and so we had a great time. And so that's an interesting thing. You know how it is to go in a studio. You're kind of nervous, especially if this guy of that statue. So, okay, Keith, let's go play to set up the mics. I said, you wear the charts. He says, I don't do charts.
Sure.
You just play. Shit. So anyway, but it was great. He gave us tickets for the Steel World, tour. So we got to hear him. So it was a great experience.
Man, I'll bet.
But I'm not a studio musician.
That was Steve Jordan on that
Steve Jordan
session.
Was producing. Yeah, in fact, I have a picture of us three. It's pretty amazing.
Nice.
Steve Jordan, bad.
Man, what a monster, man.
Yeah. Yes, so we had a great time. And I mean, we partied. You know, I'm not going to talk about what we did, but it was very nice.
You can use your imagination.
You can use your imagination. And let's just put it away. They had more serious stuff as the night grew in. And I remember the last thing I said, it was 2 o'clock or something in the morning. I said, I know you're Keith Richards, but I'm tired and I got to go home.
I'm not.
So, I'm not exactly. So you stay here. I mean, he brought his wife there and everything.
Right.
I mean, we had a great time.
Well, he's a real family guy. I mean, you know, people think of Keith as being like, you know, some kind of real,
he is
obviously
that too.
He is that. But, you know, I was watching this documentary and I can't think of which one it was, but Keith was talking about, they're saying, you must have, bedded a lot of women or chased a lot. He goes, man, I've never picked up a girl in my life. He said, I wouldn't know how. I would have no idea. He said, every girl that's ever, they've always approached me. He said, I'm not like that, man.
What a problem to have.
Well, yeah. You know, I guess if you don't have the gift of gab or you don't have that easy come on, you got to become a world famous rock musician,
He did it. He's still doing it. That's what's amazing.
But what I was starting to say is he's a real family guy. Like, he's always, if you see photographs, he's always got his family around him. He's been married to the same woman forever, His kids are all there. He's
a regular guy.
He's
he's a regular and very warm. I mean, because, I mean, you know, this is kind of intimidating. You know, and it just made me feel, I said, hey, you want a drink? What are you drinking? Rebel Yell and ginger ale. That's how we started the session.
Okay. Where was that session?
Some studio with the record plant in New York City,
okay.
I believe.
Right on.
So I got there, that day, and we tried to, the car picked me up, went to the hotel, I picked up a fiddle, couldn't play anything. So I said, let me go take a walk in Central Park. And so I was kind of nervous, but I mean, not after meeting him.
Yeah.
It was a wonderful experience.
So going back, you and Zachary, your cousin, your third cousin, Zachary Richard, who was a guy, again, I didn't realize that you had this history. I know Zachary at one point was kind of militant about the French thing. Like, he wouldn't even speak English at certain periods with people.
Ralph Zachary is a great actor.
Okay.
Okay. And that's good. I mean, if you're a musician, you should be. We had this thing, he went his junior year. He went to Tulane. I went to LSU. He went his junior year. He went to abroad. He went to Scotland. So he got into it. So he was a Scottish musician at that time. He spoke with a brogue. Okay. And anyway, so we went to visit, because we were good friends. I mean, we played together. We went to the same school together. We went to visit Mark Savo, and he bought an accordion. And so, you know, I said, well, I have this fiddle somewhere. You know, T. Will has it, but I never thought about it. So I played guitar. So he and I started playing. And then I graduated that in 73 in December. So I had a whole, you know, almost 6-7 months before I was going to go to graduate school. I was a Blake student, William Blake, to go to Albuquerque. So I had a job as a waiter. And he and I, we'd play, and he wasn't in the militant stage at that time. We were just fun doing this up and learning. So there was a place called Fadnall Stutes outside of Lafayette. Have you ever heard of this place?
No.
Okay, this is an old sort of, you could call it a roadhouse, but it's like, so on a gravel road, it had two gas pumps out, the kind with the, I mean, this is ancient history, the kind with the little butterfly that when you pump gas, it would roll around.
I don't know if you
remember that.
Sure.
It was a duplex. So on the left side, looking at the place, there was a barber chair in the middle. It was a grocery store. He was justice of the peace. On the other side was a bar, so you could go there, get married, get your hair cut, have a reception. Of course, the bathrooms are outside. Gas up your car and leave. So we start, you know, we didn't have that many places to play in that time for us. It wasn't, we weren't like a band or you know, playing for dances. And so we're playing there on the pool table. We're playing for drinks, you know, so you know where that is. And this guy came in from France, and he was looking for young people to play musicians. And he went to Cotterfield and said, well, you know, these two guys are playing there. So, you know, there's not too many places around. So he said, you want to play a festival in France, stay for 2 weeks? Duh. Yeah. And so we did.
So you and Zachary went over with
that? That's how the whole thing started. I heard these, we woke up, if you can imagine, it's too bad you don't have smell on your show, but if you can imagine, the first night we were in outside of Nancy, France, there's an old medieval barn. It has at least 70 cots right next to each other. These are French people who don't take baths.
Sure.
You can imagine that shit. And the snoring, man. Yeah, I never heard anything like that. But that morning, all of a sudden, I heard this noise, and it was Jolie Blonde, but I couldn't understand the instrument. They were playing it on a hurdy-gurdy, what they call in French a vielle à roue. And I mean, I said, where are we? And then so we go down there, we meet all these people, and then the people our age start singing the same ballads that my aunts were singing. And so I said, whoa, there's something deeper here. At the same festival, Jean-Pierre Bruno, I don't know if you know him, he was a film director. He did a film, and you can look it up on YouTube. It's called Dans le Sud de la Louisiane, in the south of southwest Louisiana, in southwest Louisiana. It's a great film about the Cajuns before it was sort of, I mean, it's been discovered a long time ago, but he came down there, put different musicians together, black and white, like Can Ray and Dennis would play together and things. And so this was just a film that they put it between two trees on a sheet. I said, man, I know these people, but I don't know them like that.
Yeah.
And so that's what happened. And then we played a lot in Montreal. And Montreal was very militant. That's where Ralph Zach got the militancy, which is good. I mean, because you can be, when you're young, you can find a cause.
Sure.
I was not that militant. I would say, that's okay, but I'm more interested in these people who are still alive, who have so much to share. So for me, I said, I'm going to go do the research. I'm going to go there and tape it. You know, so then I said, maybe I should be a folklorist. And I said, well, that's stupid. I'd have to study myself, so I'm not doing that. So anyway, so I just, you know, I went out and did that. So that's where our basis was. And mostly when I met these people, I'm talking about like Dennis McGee or Camp, who had recorded in 1929, and other people like that. It was amazing. So I wanted to learn the music right. Mm-hmm. And then so if I was going to represent it, for my idea was to bring these guys out. It wasn't to be a star or something like that being in the States. And it just so happens, you know, you're there. It depends where you are. We're there at the right time.
Right.
But that was 74. 2 years later, we get a call to go to France with Cotterfield for 2 weeks. Same kind of thing. And this guy, Phil Johnson, who used to be an art director at WWL, was on the trip.
Yeah.
So he did a movie of us. You can find it.
He's a bass player himself, actually, Johnson.
So he filmed us all over the place.
Okay.
I mean, we went to Napoleon's tomb and all this stuff. He even, in fact, he had a Volkswagen. You should see Phil Johnson drive in Paris, man. He lives. And he stopped his car right in the middle of the Champs-Élysées, and we got on top of his van and wrote a song called Arc de Triomphe Two-Step.
Okay.
And so, you know, we just having fun, right? And then we were there, I guess, the second week. We're on a bateau mouche in the Seine playing for all these people. And this gentleman comes up and says, "Oh, that's really interesting music. Do you have a record?" I said, "A record? Yeah, all right." And he said, "Would you like to make a record?" I said, "Yeah, sure." So he gave us his card. He was the president of EMI, Pate Marconi.
Wow.
And I said, "Look," I said, "we're only here for 4 days. No problem." So we recorded that's how we recorded our first record.
Oh, okay.
So it's like, not that we wanted to, but we just did.
Right.
And so that's that part of the story.
Nice. I love that. Well, so at this time, you know, like nowadays, Cajun music is, you've taken it all over the world, but it was not ubiquitous like that at all. I mean, it was very insular. I mean, like much music from Louisiana, it doesn't, it took a long time to cross the border of Louisiana to get into the world at large.
Yeah.
Now, like a year later or so, you formed Beau Soleil, right?
Well, Beau Soleil came out of Koto.
Okay.
You know, because Beau Soleil actually started 50 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
We just celebrated, and I'll tell you how it started. It was Bessel Duyon and Kenneth Richard and I. Bessel's father, Hector Duyon, was a fiddle player too, and they recorded in the late 30s as the Dixie Ramblers. So he had a camp in Johnson's Bayou, which was on the other side, sort of west of Holly Beach. So we went there, and we, you know, smoked to get, you know, did a lot of smoking to get rid of the mosquitoes. You know, it's horrible.
Right.
We had this, yeah, I don't know if you remember this thing, this canister, must have been DDT. It was called Bonsoir Bug. I can remember spraying this thing right. So we went over to the dance hall. It was long gone now. And Holly Beach was called the Bon Temps Roulé. So here's this typical story. We walk in there, we got long hair. All of a sudden, everybody shuts up when we walk in, and then we start speaking French, and everybody's our friend. Well, it just so happens that night was Nathan Abshire's playing. That's where I got to meet Nathan, and Bessel knew him. So it's been that kind of thing, that kind of crazy roller coaster.
Now I read a quote that I loved. You mentioned William Blake earlier. You said that when you got on this path, you traded in William Blake for Dewey Balfa.
Yeah, it was like, that was a switch. Well, I mean, the thing about William Blake is learning how to speak. Well, learn how to understand poetry. And I think, and I was very much into the mystics because, you know, being from Acadian and a small ethnic groups, we have our own, you could call them superstitions or whatever. I mean, my grandmother, like I said, was a nurse. But if I had ear problems, she would bring me to a Creole traiteur.
A traiteur, yeah, yeah.
So that was part of our lives, too. So I was always looking, and this thing was so vast. I mean, it's like, you know, you couldn't just put your finger on it and say, this is Cajun music. We never, and by the way, Renee, we never called it Cajun music. We always called it French music.
Okay.
That was, and that's, you know, changed. So it was like a very special thing. So, you know, I still study Blake. And in fact, if you look at Blake, I mean, he's written so many things. One of his poems was called America. And he kind of, it was because it was about the revolution, because he was alive around that time. But the fact is, he put, like the planets, how things happen. He gave other names to planets. And so I started doing that with Cajun music. This person did this and he created this universe of what we call French music in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really into that. So I still am, but it's not as academic.
Well, you know, and something that, like, listening to Beau Soleil, y'all play so many different styles of music. With, you know, it's a big umbrella of within this French music. I mean, you know, you play Cajun, blues, country, Zydeco, jazz, even Tex-Mex and stuff. And, you know, reminded me of this conversation I had several times with Lil Buck Senegal. And because the Iguanas would be out on tour and, you know, playing shows with
Great guys.
And, you know, would be hanging around on the side of the stage because he's a very personable, you know, warm guy. And I remember we talked about this, like I said, a number of times where he would say, you know, everybody's making this music too simple. Like they're making it the same. We used to play all kinds of music within this French music thing, and so he was kind of he was saying, oh, it's a shame that it's to the degree that it's become more regimented or more narrow or something. And but Beausoleil has always maintained that wide variety of styles.
Because I think that's what the music is made of. It's just like New Orleans music. I mean, jazz could only have been started here because of all the different influences. You know, they came to New Orleans. I mean, you got the blues, you got, you know, American songs, you have French songs, you have brass songs. And the same thing happened with, you know, doing research with our French music, because a concert, and what, you know, this is a house dance, but they call fado doze, basically. The repertoire would be, you play a two-step, then you play a waltz, then you play a valse à deux temps, then you play a mazurka, then you play a cotillion, then you play a reel. You know, it was not like, it's not simple at all.
Right.
And these people had more together than we ever did. So that's what I was more interested in. And I said, let's go with that tradition. And, you know, I try to, I love world music. I mean, I've always have. And I probably opened my ears being in France and their acceptance of music. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that all my influences are here.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have to go out of Louisiana to be influenced, but from classical down.
Right.
I mean, when we received a grant in 1979. It was the last Franco-American grant because it became Spanish after that. But anyway, it was a grant at USL at that time. And for the history of our music, we did research to do the first Acadian dictionary. They had people teaching Cajun French or trying to put together a book. I mean, there was no book really on that. They had architecture, women down there, textiles. It was a great grant, and so I was asked to be. I was an adjunct professor. Mm-hmm. So the name of my course was French Music in Louisiana, Opera de Zydeco. So that's kind of where I wanted to see it. And so, because everybody had blinders on. I mean, if you're from Ville Platte, that's the only music there is to them. You know, and that's okay. That's cool. It's just as good in that way, but that's not how I saw it. So I was lucky. I applied for some grants. I mean, I didn't know they would give Cajun grants. I mean, you talk about, and Nick said, yeah, they gave it to you. I mean, you're American. I said, well, sorta, you know, and so that's why, you know, I started getting grants and applying for grants. And to kind of show the different fiddle styles of what was going on, because you could go, well, you know, you go 40 miles away, you could play the same song, but it'd be completely different. And so I was really interested in that and how this music developed and continued, because it was kind of perilous times back there in the late 60s and early 70s. I mean, there were fewer people going. So sad in 1970, there were 100,000, no, there was a million people who spoke French in Southwest Louisiana. So they said, the census. Mm-hmm. Then you go back to 2000, there are less than 100,000 French-speaking people in Louisiana. And that's just that's how it goes.
Right.
I mean, we've been here for over 250 years and still not assimilated, basically.
Yeah, sure. Well, and that's a good thing. I love that along with this, you know, you developing personally as a musician, you're also performing this kind of anthropology, this preservationist function.
Yeah.
Where you're going back, you're finding these guys before they're gone, digesting their fiddle styles. I mean, that's really where you came into your own as a fiddle player.
Because that's what's important. I mean, these people, they had the tenacity to save this music, but they weren't considering themselves saving the music. They were just playing the music. That's who they were. And it was the real thing that they could remember. That was one constant thing. Because, I mean, when you look at it, the accordion probably wasn't introduced into our culture until maybe 1900.
Uh-huh.
Nobody knows. There are pictures before that, but who knows? And then when they started recording 20 years later, almost 30 years later, they were very proficient people on the accordion by 1928 and 29.
Right.
So, you know, the music has to evolve. And we're just at the right place at the right time.
Right, right. Well, speaking of time, I'm looking at my drink and looking at the clock, and this seems like a good time to take a little break, Michael.
Let's take a little break.
So everybody in the Feral Zone knows what to do. Go get yourself another cocktail, and we'll be right back.
dans le Québec. Oh, fallait-nous avoir non pas un mariage du jour en regrettant nos heures et temps passés.
And we're back inside the Feral Zone. I am Renee Coman, sitting here with my guest, Mr. Michael Doucet. Now, Michael, I know you're new to this podcast. You're new to podcasts in general. But I will tell you, the rest of our listeners know that this is a listener-supported operation. And to that end, we have a Venmo and a PayPal link in the show notes of every show, as well as in the Facebook posts that we put up to promote them. And so please avail yourself of those links. Support the podcast if you're enjoying these scintillating guests that we have week in and week out, such as Mr. Michael Doucet. Jump on that. Also, we have a Patreon link there if you want to take all the guesswork out of supporting the podcast. Also, we have the Troubled Men Podcast t-shirt link there. And I want to give a shout out to Arnie Skog, who bought two t-shirts this week. For who knows who, but someone's got a
it's Christmas.
A happy Christmas coming to them when they open that, get to put on those Troubled Men Podcast t-shirts. Also, follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook. Rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening to it. Give it 5 stars. Cost you nothing. Helps us a lot. Also, you can find all my dates with the Iguanas at iguanas.com. And I'll say you can find all of Beausoleil's dates at beausoleilmusic.com. And that y'all have a bunch of dates coming up after you're playing St. Louis Cathedral tomorrow. But you have dates reaching out 6 months in advance. So you can...
it's unbelievable.
See those guys.
That's on these days?
Yeah. And what else? You can follow the Renee Coman Facebook page for any of my non-Iguanas dates. And so that's enough of that. Let's get back to Michael. So Michael, we're just in the narrative where Beausoleil is now becoming a band in the 70s or early 80s, traveling the world. And again, this is not a time when this music had been widely disseminated. Now, that must have blown people's minds when you came out with this.
It totally did. I mean, like I said, we started out in France, and we played a lot of French-speaking countries. Canada was the other main thing. Because that's when, they were fighting for their French during that time, too. So that's how we saw the group. I mean, we could make a living going to Europe and stuff like that. But then, things happened. And so out of Coteau, came, Beausoleil. And then, you end up, you have to get a job one day. So that was my job. But we were still playing music. And I worked for the Diocese of Lafayette.
Oh, okay.
For about 8 years. And
really? As a teacher or something? Or?
No, head of communications.
Okay.
And I used to do French radio show. I mean, I don't know if I ever told you this, Missy. So we used to do... French, everything was in French, so we'd do the French rosary. So we'd have to tape it. We had a truck in it. So we did it. We did it with this guy.
Say the rosary in French.
Say the rosary in French. And so we did it like we taped it on a Saturday and aired on the Sunday or Monday morning, or really early, or 5 o'clock,
Just going through saying, doing the whole
rosary
whole
in French.
Circle.
So I get to work on the Monday, and I have like 25 calls. We forgot a Hail Mary.
Oh.
So I had to go back and edit the extra Hail Mary. I mean, we missed it totally. So anyway, but in fact, the first record we did for Our Huli, and back in one of the places that I worked, there was a beautiful, it must have been from the turn of the century, little chapel, beautiful acoustic place. So that's where Chris Strakowicz bought his two Neumann mics and recorded Beausoleil. That's the album is called Michael Doucet, Debo Soleil, or Arhuli. And that kind of started a thing because that was like in 81. Ben Sandmill, who we know didn't know then, used to write different people for Downbeat. He gave us like 5 stars.
Nice.
And I said, there was no production. It was a live recording.
Uh-huh.
And he loved it. And then I get a call from Minnesota's this thing called Prairie Home Companion. I said, I don't want any. He said, no, that's a radio show. And so we go up there. I remember the date. It was January 15th, actually, 1982, because the album came out in 81. It was like 10 below zero. Their place that they were in before, it had a big snowfall. The roof caved in, so they had to move to another building. Another performer's place. And so they were all running around like chickens with their necks, heads cut off. And so we were it was like we left Louisiana. It was like 75 degrees,
right,
you know.
Sure.
And so we're just there doing our thing. And so that's where I met Garrison. And I'll never forget that show because he kept on saying, do you know another song? I mean, we must have played like 30 minutes on that first show.
He just couldn't get enough. Never heard that. It was infectious to him.
It was amazing. And because that was a powerful show back then.
Sure.
And he
Public radio. It was
the highlight.
Yeah, man.
And so we befriended each other. He invited us to his house. He was a big scotch drinker at that time. Even further on down the street, when he got married again to Olga, his high school sweetheart from Denmark.
Nice.
He had his daughter come spend 2 weeks with us to learn how to speak Cajun French, which we did. We mostly ate food, but nevertheless, we did some things. And so that was an amazing thing that happened. But we were never looking for that kind of stuff.
Sure.
You know, it was still us. We had a gig at Mulots. We played every week. We were fine. Played New Orleans every week. And then it started.
That's very Louisiana approach there. Yeah. It's like, I don't really want to leave. I
know, man. Why? And so, but we always said we wanted to live in Louisiana. We didn't want to do the Nashville thing or whatever it took to do that. And so in 86, they basically said, I wanted to take a sabbatical. So I said, let's give it a year or 9 months. And so
we just being a road band.
That's when it started. So then that's when I decided, well, we're just going to Cajunize the United States.
Okay.
And that's what we did. So from that, we played every state in the Union more than 3 times, including Mississippi and North Dakota, and a lot of stores. So I can tell, I'm sure like you could tell, you want to name a state or town, I'll tell you where to drink coffee, tell you where, to eat. And so we had a great time doing that. And I think because we lucked out in the things. Because we had a great agency, the Rosebud Agency.
Which
is really big for here. I mean, there they had Bonnie Raitt, J.J. Cale. They had the Nevilles for a while. And so we were really happy to do that.
Los Lobos.
Exactly.
Well, the Iguanas Agency is a mongrel. And Brad Madison
used to work for you.
Worked
exactly.
for Rosebud for 10 years. In fact, when he started Mongrel, he's like, I've been working for Rosebud for 10 years. They won't sign any new acts. Yeah. I think I might start my own agency if you guys will come with me. And we're like, okay. Well.
No problem. That's how it happens. It's one of those, but you got to be there.
Right.
And so, yeah, you remember that, because we were talking about that when they moved, they had the jazz festival, went to Philadelphia, the Jambalaya Jam.
Right.
Which was an amazing thing. I mean, from Toussaint to Dr. John, to us, to y'all. And it was just, we took over that. And of course, it's so successful. And everybody thinks, oh, that's so easy. They brought the whole jazz festival crew. So the city of Philadelphia says, oh, we can do that. Well, then it lasted 1 year.
Yeah, well, it's like when people try to have Mardi Gras places, they wind up burning their whole downtowns down, a lot of assaults and cars set on fire and turned over, And it's like, look, we make it look easy. We make it look good. Please don't think that you can do what we're doing. It really warms my heart when I go to Mardi Gras every year, and because, the nation or maybe the world has a certain idea of Mardi Gras for a long time or for a certain number of years in the 2000s or so. It had kind of a girls gone wild image of Mardi Gras that it was women taking their tops off. And I had to go around as I'm traveling. I was like, that's not Mardi Gras, man. Mardi Gras, you're sitting there with your grandmother and your nieces. So nobody's taking their clothes off. That's some spring break kind of stuff, man. That's has been imposed upon us. And Look, where is it now? It's gone. That's not something that stuck. Because that's not part of the of our culture, you know.
That's a good deal. Well, yeah, I mean, there's it can be all of that, but you're right. There's a certain, I don't know, a certain austerity to it. I mean, it's funny, you know, Mardi Gras. Everybody goes there to have a good time and party, and I'm saying
it's all that. Yeah,
it could be. I mean, I wrote this song called "Walking on a Mardi Gras Day," and it's the opposite about that. It's about like, oh, I'm feeling really bad. What's going on? You know, how do you do this thing? And if I'm catching bees, you know, I'm catching bees for you, where are you? You know, kind of things like that. And you know, like you said, you just experience that. And I think that's the main thing. You experience it firsthand. You don't own it. Nobody right. needs to own this thing just to do it. And one of the best times I ever had, my brother David belonged to some crew at one time. I think it was the Mid-City crew. Anyway, it was so much. I don't know if you've ever ridden on a float and throw bees, but man, that's a blast.
I rode for about two blocks on the St. Patrick's Day parade one time just because somebody pulled me up onto the float. So I got two blocks to experience, like, okay, this is why people
like
this.
That was enough.
Well, it's not something I ever aspired to do, but I got the perspective. It was like, okay, this is what people like about this.
You're throwing away plastic stuff except for the glass, you know, necklaces,
right?
And it's amazing how people will they'll come up, do you have any doubloons? I mean, like, this, I'm gonna die if you don't give me a doubloon. Okay.
So you guys wind up on Prairie Home Companion. It gets, you know, your music is splashed all around the country, you know, all these public radio stations all around, and then you guys go overseas. Now, at that time, you guys were like the tip of the spear. Man, you guys opened so many doors for other, you know, French music, South Louisiana music that came after that, man. I mean, that must be pretty gratifying, huh? Could you imagine at that time that your music would be so ubiquitous across the globe?
You know, that's kind of like a dream. I just wanted to play it right and respect the elder musicians and whatever. People liked it, didn't like it. It didn't really matter to us, Renee. I mean, you know, there was only one gig. It was at some winery, you know, wine place in California. And everybody's getting drunk, and we're playing that. And so we heard somebody just shout, why don't you sing in English? And so I thought about it. I said, well, if he's singing in English, I wouldn't be here.
I wouldn't have a job.
You know? And so I think that helped. And, yes, it's amazing how we did that. I mean, it's a different language. But this is American music, as you well know. And it's only created one place in the world. And just lucky to be part of that. And I think everybody who does play and had a chance to go out, I mean, there was no roadmap. We sort of bulldozed the roadmap. This is how you do it. And we had it down. And, you know, and then all of a sudden we come up from this era of just playing for dances. Then you're in a 2,000-seat auditorium and you have to talk and make sense.
Uh-huh.
There goes the Bud Light, you know, and you know what I mean. It's like, oh man, I got to be on my toes, and
you're the front man. You're doing all the talking.
Yeah,
right?
So it's like you got to be there, and that was great. And we met a lot of people, and so you know, from that time, I don't think I can almost say this, almost. And we were talking about the '80s because Paul Prudhomme came here like in '80, Burned the Fish, and he asked us to go to New York with him, and we did, and that was a trip. Paul Prudhomme took over New York.
Right.
And we played there was a place called the Iguana, actually,
okay,
in New York City. And then it changed to the Lone Star, same people. Anyway.
Sure, yeah. Played
so
the Lone
Star, we were lucky, but you're right. And then we had, because I wanted to be on every label in the United States, you know, record labels. So we were on like Blue Note, we were on Swallow, we were on EMI. We were on a Canadian label I can't even remember the name of. And then our Hooli, of course, then Rounder.
So many great labels.
Yeah,
man.
But then Rhino. Gary Stewart, who was the ER guy for Rounder.
God bless him, man.
Gave me a CD like in 1986, 85. And I said, what's this? He said, this is a CD. I said, I don't have a CD player. He says, you will. And so because of Chris Trackway, it looks like we were the first Cajun group to have a CD. That was in 1986 on our Hooli, and he, along with Clifton Chenier the same year.
Nice.
But that's another story, but all that kind of stuff. But I mean, right. That's how music evolves.
I was going to ask you about all these younger bands that play this music with a, you know, they're younger guys. They got a fire in the belly and stuff, you know.
We were young ones,
and,
too.
Well, so then I start watching videos of you guys like, fuck, man, you guys were so raucous, man.
I mean, we were drinking a lot. Okay, at the Maple Leaf, I'm sure you
just the style of music, just the way you played the music was so much verve, man. I mean, it's...
thank you. That's called Mashdown. Okay. I mean, I say if you're going to play it, give it 100%, even if you played wrong. Our deal with John Parsons at the Maple Leaf, we put a case in an ice chest. We were sitting down playing it, just on the mics in front of us. When we got through drinking the case, we take a break. They replenish the case. When we finish that, we get in the car and drive back to Lafayette.
Sure.
Why are we still alive? Got angels, baby. Got
that's
angels.
Right, that's right. Right. God's watching. Well, we're doing God's work, Michael. So,
right.
You know, he knows who's important, who he can spare.
The gods are watching. Yeah. There was somebody's watching. We're still alive. But, I mean, that was part of it. You know, the part was a fun. I mean, it was a party. We knew that. And also, I mean, because that's what we learned from my elders. I mean, you know, that generation before me, they partied hard, too.
Sure.
But most Americans, I think, I mean, we had so many different people saying that. One of the guys we played in, it was in New England. He came up to me, very sincere, of course. Says, you know, I didn't understand a word you said. He said, but that's okay. I love opera. I don't understand Italian. It's just, it's sure. The same thing.
Yeah.
You know, and then another person, I remember we were in California. This woman said, I didn't even know the word Cajun. I'm moving to New Orleans.
Oh, really?
Said, you know, so it's like, you know, you don't know, you plant a seed, you don't know what's going to happen. And then, we'd always ask people to come down thinking that they wouldn't. Well, they all did. And so now it's like, you can't go to, I don't think there exists as a dance hall with just people from Louisiana. And that's okay. Everybody's got to intermarry every now and then. And it's just a different world now, but it's still... You know, you were asking about young people. I think there's some people playing it right and people who have fun doing it. And, you know, I mean, come on. We're both in what used to be the music business. I don't know what it is now.
It was someone we know. They were saying, oh, it's such a shame. Look what's happened to the record business. And the person pointed out, well, 150 years ago, there was no such thing as a record business. Music has been going on for a long time.
That's right.
So the music is not dependent on the record business. The record business was dependent on the music. So maybe that's a little blip, and this is a reversion to the mean, you know, like the music is the thing.
I hope it is, but it's a lot more expensive now to live than it was 150 years ago. But you're right. I mean, the whole, there's that spark. Like Dennis McGee had, I mean, and Johnny Gimble had. You know, they always had their ups and downs, but music was the thing that they had. Music is just, it's a language, you know that, and it's like anything that could lift people's spirit, where it be a religion or whatever, I mean, or an idea of spirituality or whatever,
yes,
or just a feeling.
It's a connection to the divine, you know?
Something that you can't see.
Yes.
But you can hear.
Yes.
You can't touch it, but you know, don't touch my violin either.
But you know it's real. It's undeniable.
We're here because some kind of electrical system is making our heartbeat, and that creates a sound. So we're vibrating right now. And when you hit, and you know exactly what I'm talking about, when you hit that vibrational thing, it's like, I call it the zone.
Yep.
When you get there, and this is it. And like you're playing it right, the whole, everybody's working, it's clicking, man, it's nothing like it.
No, nope, that's for sure, man. Now, you and I have crossed paths over our, you know, many years of our careers, yeah. This last year we wound up both of us at the behest of Kenny Martinez Bergmeier there in Hawaii at the Big Island Jazz and Blues Festival, and we got to spend a lot of time together.
We went snorkeling and all that stuff.
Well, I barely made it back. I think that might be my last snorkeling trip. When at the end of that day, I was hanging out with Delfio Marcellus, an old friend of mine. We went to school together. I studied with his dad, and I was telling him about how I was 8 feet away from the boat, and I wasn't sure I was going to make it back.
It was that big fish that kind of helped you go aboard.
And now the night before, I think you were in Kenny's room when he was inviting us to go on that snorkeling trip. And he texted Delphio and his wife and said, "We're doing this trip in the morning. Would you like to go?" And Delphio immediately responded, "Certainly not."
I get in that water with that fish, man.
Why? Why would I want to do that? So then I'm that night I'm talking to Delphio and I'm cracking up, recalling that, you know, and how I was so out of breath. He goes, "Well," I said, "I don't know if it's like my lungs are getting worse, you know. I haven't smoked in 20 years, but I smoked for 20 years before that." And he said, "Well, you know, your lungs lose elasticity with age anyway, so that's not unusual." He said, "I never smoked, but my lungs are, I don't have the capacity I had when I was 20. I was like, "Okay, so maybe my snorkeling days are behind me."
You could float. Join the float club.
Yeah. Well, I need some. See, that was one of my mistakes. I meant to get one of those flotation devices, yeah, but I forgot, and I jumped in the water. And by the time I realized I'm too tired, I have to go back, I was exhausted already. I'd waited too long.
But I mean, that was so much fun. But you know, we've been to Hawaii. I love Hawaii, of course. Who doesn't? And I guess we started going there in the 80s, late 80s. And just the amount of fish and everything else it's depleted so much. It's amazing. Even yeah. that. And even the food, I mean, the Pacific, like everything. And then Maui, we didn't go to Maui, but before, I mean, the horrible fire they had at Lahaina.
Oh, man, yeah, yeah.
But some of our favorite places where the millionaires were are now being raised for the billionaires.
Okay.
and then there's no more sugarcane. I mean, that was the most amazing thing when you landed in Maui or any island. There was sugarcane everywhere. It looked like Southwest Louisiana. Then there was a lot of pineapple. There are no more pineapples and no more sugarcane. And it's like, it's a whole different place now with the whole economy and things like that.
Right.
But hey, I'd go back and so would you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, so
I'm going to get you in the water now that I know that, man. You get thrown overboard now.
You'd be like my dad pushing my head under the water.
This won't hurt. Just hold your breath.
Look. I don't even like to put my head under the water in a bath, okay?
Man, you took it. That was brave. Because we jumped in.
Well, I've been snorkeling many times before. It was not my first trip, but, you know, the water was very rough that day. Yeah. And even though we were close to shore, you can drown in a bathtub. So, you know, the fact
Renee,
that...
Renee, you can't take that.
The fact that you can see the bottom doesn't mean that you can stand on the bottom. So, anyway, moving on to later on in that day. So on that trip, that was one of my favorite groups of people that was there, that have ever been there. So it was you, your brother David, Wayne Toops, Roddy Romero, Corey Lede.
Quite a crew, man. Yeah.
Quite a crew. And Delphio was there. But the day before the big show, we had that lounge show and had you, your brother, Wayne Toops on accordion, and Roddy Romero playing slide guitar. No drums, no bass, just the quartet playing like that. And you guys sounded so fucking good, man. It was like you play with such great time. I mean, all y'all play with great time. And just the power of that.
When you perfect simplicity, it becomes something else.
Yes.
In other words, if a lot of people try to perfect the complicated part. If you start with the simple parts and build on, it becomes complicated, but then you don't see it like that.
Well, it's like Lou Reed would say, "Well, I take low art and I elevate it."
And, yeah, you would.
You know, Bowie would say, "Well, I take high art and I lower it." Now, the next day, we do sound check, and you come over to me and say, "Renee, would you and Doug Garrison back us up on our set?" And I was like, "Wow, absolutely, I will. I'm so honored that you would ask me." So I go sneak over to your brother, David, after the sound check, and I say, "David, so Michael asked me and Doug to back y'all up. What are y'all going to play?" And David goes, "I don't know, man. Some two steps, some waltzes." I said, "Well, I guess I'll be playing some two steps and some waltzes."
we have what's called a lack of a set list syndrome.
Sure.
The only time we have a set list is if we have to play less than an hour. And,
right.
And so, because, well, you know that. I mean, we're playing this music to people, Americans, whatever, English-speaking people, you don't know where they're at. And to me, you learn how to read a crowd.
Yes.
And you some kind of subliminal level, this is what they need to hear.
Yep.
And that's why people ask me, when do you write a song? Like, I'm not a craft writer. I don't have a paradigm to follow. I don't do that. My songs are all different. It's how I feel at a certain time, do it. Or, as I used to say, it's like we play a lot of different styles.
Right.
It's like a wagon wheel. Every now and then you need a new spoke. So, I mean, you're playing these traditional songs, and you say, I want to say something else. And that's how the music, that's how you create a song for me in this group. And we're still doing that. And that's amazing. And that's so much fun. And it's always been fun. So, I mean, I like to pull stuff on the group and say, oh, no, let's play in a different key this time.
You okay. know?
They love me to say that.
Right. Well, now, speaking of that, you know, a lot, like the Iguanas don't use set lists either. Our thing is we'll get like 3 songs to start the set.
Yeah,
and then, because here's my thing about, like, if you win a crowd over with those first 3 songs, you can do anything.
You're right. You're totally right. You start together, you end together, you can't, you don't care what you do.
You need to, it's like a rocket taking off. You need to escape gravity. You need to have enough thrust to escape the Earth's gravity. Yeah. Once you have air underneath your wings, you can go anywhere. So we do that now as we're in the middle of the set. We got 3 guys calling tunes. So many times I'll suggest a song and somebody else in the band goes, that's exactly what I was going to say.
Everybody agrees. The problem is if they don't agree, then you play 2 different songs at the same time, well, becomes a new song. Right?
Sometimes that has happened. But I mean, I'm always willing to have my mind change. But just interesting how of all the songs you could call, just what you're talking about, how you understand watching the crowd, the feeling in the room, the molecules moving around, you just kind of intuitively know this is the call.
And it's always better when people are dancing for some reason. Yeah. I mean, you know, they watch us. I don't know why they watch us, but I mean, they have nothing else to do. They're sitting down. But you play for people who are dancing or moving. And, you know, even if they're sitting down, they can be moving. And I think that's what you go for. You go for that feeling. This is something. Let's get into it, you know?
Yeah, man. Now, you know, preparing for this, I was going over your whole discography today and came across this record that y'all did for Yep Rock, Alligator Purse. And I remembered that actually Yep Rock, when the Iguanas were on Yep Rock at the same time, they tapped me to write a review, like an internal description.
Good.
So I don't know if you ever read that, but it was quite good.
That's why it sold at least 100 copies, right?
Sure.
Yeah, I like those guys, Yep Rock. That's what we did, Alligator Purse, and it was a joke. I mean, you know, with the producer, in between, you know how it is in a studio. It's kind of a lot of electricity there, and, you know, you're trying to play everything right, perfect and everything, and then with soul. And so, you know, in between songs, you just blurt out stuff. So I came up with, I don't know why. It's just, you know, had a little fish and his name was Jim. I put him in the water to see if he could swim. He drank all the water, ate all the soap. He died last night with a bubble in his throat. In came the doctor, in came the nurse, in came the lady with the alligator purse. Out went the doctor, out went the nurse, out went the lady with the alligator purse. And so I said, priest said, what was that? I said, what was what? And he said, that's how I said, we used to play that song doing Hopscotch. He said, we have to record it. What? And so because of that, that's why it was called Alligator Purse. So I went on eBay, found a Cuban alligator purse for, I think it was $12.
Uh-huh.
And so that's the cover.
That's the photograph
and
on the cover.
And so we're playing a place. We're playing in Milwaukee. And the stage manager, she came up. She had the same purse. Except she didn't pay $12 for that purse. And right. So I said, and so that became my alligator, you know, thing. So, things happen. I love stuff like that.
Yeah, man.
So it's not all planned out, in other words. In other words, there is no agenda with us. I mean,
sure.
Our agenda, and you know as well as I do, I mean, I'd like to say, I always told the group, I said, you know, no matter where we are, high or low, music is going to take care of it, of us, because we take care of the music. Some kind of way, you know, it might not be what we want or whatever, things like that. But I mean, we were so lucky to have so many great years. I mean, you know, we were there at the right time, riding the wave. Guess what? The wave has to hit the shore. So after 50 years, that wave has hit the shore. So we're in a We're in the backwater now. You know, going
well,
back to
as me and Manny, my co-host, who's not here, like to say, we're in the back nine. So
the back nine.
I'm just trying to enjoy my decline.
Yes, very gracefully.
Make the most of it. That's right.
I can't do anything about that.
Well, you know, you have all these people that you've played with. Now, band, we're going to close because this has been a fantastic podcast. But you mentioned some old timers, and you mentioned Ben Sandmel.
Yeah.
And so I have to ask you about the Hackberry Ramblers.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a bunch of guys. Now, did you know about the Hackberry Ramblers when you were a kid or when you were a younger man?
I think when I was a kid, it was like...
I think they started recording like in the 30s or something.
They
40s.
They had two bands. They had the Hackberry Ramblers, who recorded in French, and they had the Riverside Ramblers, which is the name of a Riverside Tires, who they record in English. And in those days, they had radio shows.
Right.
Just like we're doing now. But they would be at car dealerships and things like that. I knew Lutheran because that was one of my favorite songs he ever did, Fais Passer. In fact, we did it. I love this his style. I've never seen a person who had such a high waist. I think, you know, right under his breast, that's where his waist was.
Higher and higher as the years went on.
And he was a character, and I loved his music. But he influenced so many people. They recorded on Arhuli, and believe it or not, that's how Richard Thompson first heard about Cajun music, the great guitarist from England.
Who you wound up doing a lot of stuff with.
Well, yeah, unbelievable. I love Richard. I mean, that's all I listened to. I listened to 78 tapes and Richard Thompson.
Wow. It,
from the 70s on.
Fairport Convention.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because he wrote this song called Cajun Woman, and I went, and Mike Pilat, he says, you might like this record. You know, so it was Cajun Woman. So, this was an English guy know about Cajun Woman. Well, it's not really a Cajun song, but nevertheless, I said, well, this is pretty good. This guy's good. So when I was in, the time I went to France in 74, I went to England because we were getting ready to study William Blake, going to graduate school. Well, I had to go see Blake's plates. So I had a friend, Barry Drainsfield, who was a fiddle player, incredible fiddle player. He played on Richard Thompson's first solo record, Henry the Human Fly.
Mm-hmm.
So I stayed with Barry, and who's like a Beethoven guy. And I think that's what really, I don't know, that's what, I mean, it just showed me how to really play this music. Barry said, you must play until your fingers bleed. I said, well, okay. And so that's where I met Richard. Then all of a sudden he came to the door and he gave him an album called I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight. And I said, well, hello, you know, I said, I love your music. And that was it. And so we're playing at the Maple Leaf about 1981. And the late Tommy Como, who he was our mandolin player, we're there, we're laughing. He said, look at that guy over there. It looks like the Richard Thompson lookalike contest, you know. And then Nancy coming up to me says, hello, I'm here with Richard. I said, the Richard. And then we became friends ever since. And I'm so honored because this year he called me up. He wanted us to play for his 76th birthday party at the Royal Albert Hall.
Nice.
And I mean, nice. Yeah, it doesn't get better. And I mean, just... playing with Richards is pretty intimidating as it is, but it was so warm and so good. So we'll do a little bit with him next year, so that's good.
Oh, man, that's terrific.
But it's good to have influence. And that's what I mean. I mean, he was into it. That's what I mean. Everything's, like, related. That's what turned me on to Richard, was his writing a song using the word Cajun.
Right.
Nobody used the word Cajun, you know,
nice.
Except the Hackberry.
Sure.
The Hackleberries, as we say.
Right. Well, and just in drop just now, you mentioned Michael Pilat, who I crossed paths with years ago. That's
really?
The first time on the podcast that Michael Pilat's name has ever
come. He'll love that. He'll have to tell you about that. Yeah,
Pilat. Dino Cruz. That's how I wound up talking to Michael Pilat.
That is
on the phone. He might not have warm feelings about me, but I love you, Michael. It wasn't me.
Well, you know, Pilat did a lot. I mean, he was always
he's a tremendous. Talent, man.
Oh, yeah. Was he? I mean, when he was in Lafayette, because he was from New Orleans, but he went to school. He heard Clifton Chenier. That's why he went to USL.
Okay.
And he has in August of 1969 said, you want to go to a festival in New York? I said, no. And of course, it was Woodstock, which he went to. And then so he began working with CBS Records. And through him, that's how I made it through college, because I was a CBS rep. And then we're still friends all along. He went to New York, very successful. And it's funny because my wife now is his wife's sister.
Oh, wow. That's hilarious.
We're still not related.
look, you know, my good friend Chuck Chuck Prophet there's 2,000 people in Rock and Roll College. If you stay in long enough, you wind up knowing all of them.
What a wonderful place to be.
Absolutely. Shout out to Chuck Prophet. Thank you so much, Michael. It's been fantastic. We have a podcast here. So
this is part one?
Sure.
Yeah. We did.
We can pick it up tomorrow.
We haven't even touched on anything.
Oh, I know. We could talk forever, but, you know, people can only listen for so long.
Don't go to sleep.
For Snake and Jake's Christmas Club Lounge and Michael Doucet, I am Renee Coleman signing off from inside the Feral Zone. Good night.
love the